This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. Up first, we'll hear from guest host Jill Sheridan as she spoke with a documentarian about his new film on lost war memorabilia being returned to a World War II veteran.
Today we're talking about the 30th anniversary of the Heartland International Film Festival, which started last week and lasts until this Sunday. We'll talk to a few of the filmmakers who have projects at the event, and later we'll hear from someone from Heartland to talk about how they put it all together this year. And we're joined now by Bob Massey, executive producer of the documentary Letters Home. Welcome, Bob. So can you tell us, what is this documentary about?
Hi, Jill. Thank you very much for having me today. Letters Home is the story of a couple of history sleuths. My son is a Marine Corps veteran, and we have, for a long time, found World War II memorabilia that's been separated from the families. We've researched the story behind the soldier, put it together, and then tracked the families down to reinstate these things to the families. So often they get lost in estate sales and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, it just so happened in one instance, we tracked the family down and found that the World War II soldier was still alive and had an absolute heartrending, wonderful reunion of this soldier with the memorabilia that he had lost 40 years ago. Wow. So this is the story of that process of my son and I doing our thing and ultimately finding Joe Barris in Utica, New York.
Wow. So obviously you have a real passion for the topic of this documentary. And when you heard this story, was that the real impetus for the idea for your film?
Well, actually, I had just retired from my longtime business, turned it over to my son-in-law, and had always wanted to do documentary filmmaking. Well, I was casting about for a project when this was going on. And my wife said, honey, you want to make a movie? Why don't you just tell the story of what you and Matt are doing? Because it certainly has emotional power with connecting with this 90-year-old combat veteran who was just moved to his depths that we found this and returned it. So that became the first project in my third or fourth career.
And we're going to get into your previous career as well, because it's interesting, your background. But when you're deciding, you know, when you come across a story like this, why make a documentary? Has it always been a passion of yours, like you said, to make documentaries? I mean, you could tell the story in a lot of ways. Is that right?
That's a really great question. This seemed to me like it could be best told as a documentary about this journey that my son and I have and the happy conclusions. This happened to be the most moving one, but we've had some really amazing family connections. We just never had this connection with the soldier himself. Joe is still alive, and it all worked out for us. We could have taken a different path, but because it was my first film, I felt like it would be better to tell it. I have a lot of passion about history and history telling. So I felt like it'd be better to tackle something like that than a scripted drama, and wade into some place that I didn't have a lot of experience in writing or in other artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like working with your son on a project like this?
It's great. For anybody who gets a chance to see this, my son makes the comment that my dad and I work really well together. He's never met a stranger, and I like to stand in the corner and just watch everybody. So we're really yin and yang. He's a great, big, good-looking Marine Corps veteran, and I'm short, fat, and ugly. And so we just go together perfectly, you know?
And he has a real passion for telling these stories as well.
Oh, yeah. His grandfather was a World War II veteran. I'm actually on a set right now for a filming tomorrow, so if you hear a bunch of noise in the background, that's what's going on. So in addition to his appreciation of that with his own grandfather, the Marine Corps drills into these guys the respect of the folks on whose shoulders they stand. And so Matt has always been very passionate, and he's actually an expert in military symbology, in the meaning of the awards and the medals and the devices and all that are given to soldiers, airmen, Marines, and sailors for the service that they render. So yeah, he's very committed.
So you said this is your first film. When did you start making this movie?
I started this in 2016. We actually showed it to a meeting of the American Legion Auxiliary in 2017. It was their national convention. They had been very encouraging of the project for reasons you can imagine. And I actually got on the plane and left Reno and that convention and went straight to Utica for Joe's birthday. It was Labor Day weekend. We had a wonderful surprise birthday party for him. And in addition to the surprise of seeing the film that had been made about him and his service, we also had a big family gathering where a brother and a sister that had been estranged for 25 years came, a wonderful family reunion, and 2 weeks later, Joe passed away. Mm. So the timing was wonderful. The family has been so deeply appreciative of this little surprise. You know, this was just came out of nowhere for them, came out of nowhere for us, but it just worked out wonderfully.
So talk a little bit about your background then. You know, you didn't have a filmmaking background. You came from a business in your previous life, yes?
Well, I started life as a professional musician, and I've always been a writer and an artist. I was in the ministry for 12 years, and a set of circumstances took me into business in 1987. So my business was successful, and 2015, I turned it over to my son-in-law, with whom I'd worked for 25 years, said, you're going to pay my salary for a while. I'm going to go do something I've always wanted to do. And that's how I got in the filmmaking business.
So, you know, as someone with a business background, a lot of people starting out in the film industry might not have that background. Are these worlds often separated? And do you think that artists really have or need a better understanding of business?
It would be greatly beneficial to them. Years ago, I did a recording in Nashville. I was in on a session, and there was a guitar player named Billy Grammer that was one of the fixtures around Nashville in that era of recording. And we were on a break, and Billy and I were sitting chatting. And I had come into Nashville. I didn't live there. Billy lived there. He was always on these recording gigs. And we were talking about the talent and the amazing number of great musicians that come through Nashville, Tennessee. And Billy looked at me and he said, Bob, it's a really good secret. But for every one of me, there's 25 better musicians standing out on the street, but they just want to keep their heads in songs and music and not in how to make a living. Yeah. So that was a good lesson back in the days when I was a starving artist too. So yes, I think business training, business support, helping artists find the practical way to express their vision that's a wonderful subject, which you might guess I'm passionate about.
And have you been able to talk to some young artists about business and how they might better delve into that side of it?
Absolutely. Every chance I get with any young person in any area, but especially in this area. And it's funny, when Rocky, one of your other guests, and I were sitting waiting for the call to start, this is exactly what we were talking about. He's a successful filmmaker for 15 years in Noblesville. And we were both talking about how important it is for the business aspect of film to work to support the creative side. And we were actually chatting about the possibility of how do we get the filmmaking community together and see if we can't help bring in resources and boost that in Indiana. You know, one of the issues that we face in Indiana is not the lack of talent. Mm-hmm. It's the lack of incentives. For example, Atlanta and Chicago both have really amazing tax incentives that the big filmmakers take huge advantage of. And we've had folks here in the state that have lobbied the General Assembly for several years and just can't get it through these people's heads that we're not giving money away, we're doing tax credits, which means they get to take a portion of the taxes they would pay to help offset their costs. But those are taxes they would pay only if they come to Indiana. So they're going to Atlanta and Chicago and other places. Hollywood has been really hit hard by the problem because places like Seattle and Atlanta and Chicago have come up with great programs that help the business side of this. And so we would love for that to happen in Indiana, and there is still pressure on for that to happen. It's not moving very quickly, though.
No, I've definitely heard that issue in the State House for a number of years. So maybe we'll see it this year. So talk a little bit about, you know, what was the most challenging part of making this film for you?
Wow. not wanting to do every job on the set. I mean, the challenge, there was so little challenge. It was like put an instrument in a musician's hand with a great piece of music and say, what's the greatest challenge? Oh, my gosh. It's like stopping playing. It's such a magnificent, fulfilling experience.
And quickly, we have about 45 seconds left. So you're on the set now. What are you working on?
We have brought the members of the 9/11 Commission to Indiana University. They all gathered yesterday. We're doing small group filmings today. Tomorrow they will be on stage at Indiana University Auditorium filming for 5 hours for a documentary called Are We Safer Today? That will air nationally on public television next fall. AreWeSaferToday.com.
Well, congratulations, Bob, and thank you.
Thank you, Jill. I really appreciate the privilege.
Absolutely. Bob Massey is executive producer of the documentary Letters Home, featured at the Heartland International Film Festival that kicked off last week.
Coming up, we'll hear about the history and culture of the Miami Tribe, one of the largest groups in the Indiana Territory before their removal in the 1840s. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. And it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we learn about the history and culture of the Miami Tribe, one of the largest groups in the Indiana Territory before their removal in the 1840s. We're joined now by Diane Hunter, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Picongi, Community Programming Manager, also from the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, talking about the culture and history of the Miami Tribe and people in Indiana. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Diane, I want to start by asking you, who are the people of the Miami Tribe for people who are tuning in and learning about this for the first time?
The Miami Tribe of Oklahoma is a federally recognized sovereign nation. Our ancestral homelands are Indiana and surrounding areas, but because of two removals, our tribe is now located in northeastern Oklahoma. But many Miami people still live in Indiana. We have over 800 citizens of our tribe in Indiana.
You mentioned the removal. Where did the Miami people live in Indiana before their removal?
Most of our villages were along the Wabash River, in the Wabash River Valley. And Fort Wayne was one of our large village areas. We had a number of villages in what has become Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And Doug, when we talk about the relationship between the tribe and the American government before the removal, what was that like?
The relationship between the tribe and the federal government, I would say that it was, I wouldn't say combative, but definitely a battle between the tribe and the government in terms of treaties and the government continued, you know, constant want for our homelands. And this is something I think Diane probably could speak better to than myself.
Yeah, Diane, is there anything you can add to that?
Yes, I think that after the American Revolution, the Americans started coming onto our land, as Doug was saying, and they wanted our land and they wanted more and more of our land. And so the relationship tended to be a lot of talking about, we want your land, we want you to cede the land, and we want you to go west of the Mississippi River. We don't want just the land, but we want you out of here. And every time we say, no, 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 we're not going. So it was many years, well over a decade of that back and forth. We want your land, we want you to go. And a lot of the relationship dealt right around that whole issue.
And so what happened to the Miami tribe and its people? I see that it was something in the 1840s when this was going on.
Yes, so in 1840, we finally did sign a treaty to cede the last of our lands, our tribal lands in Indiana. And we agreed at that point to be removed to land west of the Mississippi in what is today Kansas. But we didn't want to go. And so we kept putting it off. We were given 5 years to remove, and those 5 years passed. And we were still delaying removal. And so in October of 1846, that is 175 years ago right now, the soldiers came. They forcibly took us from our villages to a prison camp in Peru, Indiana. And then on October 6th, 1846, they boarded more than 300 Miami people onto 5 canal boats at Peru and took us on the canals to Cincinnati. And then from Cincinnati on steamboats on the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers to what is now Kansas City. And then over land 50 miles to the Miami Reservation in what is today Kansas. And that was to be our new home. We lived there about 20 years. And then the U.S. government wanted us to remove again. And this time it was to northeastern Oklahoma. And that is why the tribe, the seat of our government, is in northeastern Oklahoma today after those two removals.
I mean, these are very painful memories and things to talk about. Doug, what is it like when you hear these stories?
Well, you know, having a family member on the canal boat that went west. Now, granted, when they got there, they came back in the spring. But for me, you know, it does stir emotions of, it's hard to comprehend what they were experiencing then. There's documentation of tribal citizens picking up clods of dirt, you know, and putting it in their bags because they knew that that was the last time that they were going to be in their homelands. And that's something that's just, it's hard to imagine to think that, you know, this is a place that you've called home since basically time immemorial, and now you're being forced to go to a place that you've never been. So it definitely draws emotion, and I get a little emotional myself as well. Yesterday, down at Miami University, they did a commemoration of that 175th removal, and there was this walk that we took from the art museum to the Miami Center, and it was a solemn walk. I know the people that I walked with, the tribal citizens, very few words were said. And I think it was, you know, recognizing that there were over 300 souls that were removed from our homelands. So.
Yeah, that's definitely something that you really can't put into words, and I'm sure experiencing it. And how about the feeling of being back to where your ancestors were, being back in Indiana where everything started?
Well, again, for my family, you know, we never left the homelands. Mm-hmm. And I have those connections to place. I can go to Seven Pillars and experience, you know, that connection to that place there. I can go down to, is it Jalapa, Indiana, where my family reserve was. And I have those connections to those places today. And it's something that has never been lost in my family. But yet I have relatives out in Oklahoma that have never been here. And I have one relative that one of her ancestors had married one of mine, and they are both buried in the Mashingo Mishi Cemetery, and she's never been here to visit that relative, to the best of my knowledge. And when I go down there, I'll snap a photo of their headstone and send it to her and just let her know that, you know, I'm visiting our relatives. So for me, you know, it's a privilege to live here in Indiana as a Miami person and as a citizen of the Miami tribe. And again, you know, I have tribal members that have come here, and I've shown them these places around Indiana, and you take them to these places where our ancestors lived, and you see it on their faces, this emotion that exists, that they're making that connection to their homes. And this is something that removal created, was this disconnect between our tribal citizens and the land, or our homelands in particular. So for me, the biggest thing I really, really enjoy is when I have tribal members or tribal citizens from Oklahoma that come here, and I can see the joy in their faces and the emotion that they feel. It can be, you know, they get overwhelmed with emotion when they come to some of these places here.
Yeah, that's got to be a remarkable feeling to connect with your ancestral homeland and find where you've come from. I think a lot of people are longing to know where they're from. What are their histories? And to be able to get that firsthand must be so amazing. Diane, what about for you? What are your thoughts?
My family also was exempted from removal. We were allowed to stay when others were removed. However, one of my family members went. He was a 16-year-old boy and went on removal because he couldn't bear to see the rest of his relatives who were not exempted going. And he actually died as a result of the removal. I think about him a lot, and I think about his mother. We have a letter from his mother that she wrote after she heard that he had died. And I really can connect with her as a mother myself through her words at the loss of her son that to her was so unnecessary. It didn't have to happen, and it did. And so I connect through her as well as through the land, that, like Doug, I go to certain places and I know this is where this happened, or this is where we lived, or this is where this event was, or this place was important to us because. And it's a connection that I'm hoping, as Doug related, that more and more of our tribal citizens in who live outside of Indiana, because we have 6,000 altogether and only 800 and some live in Indiana, I would love at some point if every one of them could come and experience the homeland that their ancestors left so many years ago.
And what is it that you're hoping to do with the work that you do in terms of bringing back the culture, reminding people about their history?
So much of our history got lost. One of the effects of removal is that we were separated people, we were divided people. And when that happens, our culture and our language began to go dormant. And so now the tribe is working to revitalize our language and our culture and teach our people all those things that had not been forgotten, but just were not really a part of our lives for a period of time, so that we can all connect to our ancestors who lived here in Indiana, who went on removal, or who tearfully said goodbye to our relatives who went on removal. And part of that is learning our history. Part of that is engaging with each other as Miami people and learning about not only our history, but aspects of our culture, and participating in activities that we participate in because we are Miami people.
Well, I understand, Doug, that you were trying to bring back the Miami language that was dormant for almost 30 years. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Well, actually, I'm not the person responsible for that effort. That effort started back in the 90s when Julie Olds, the cultural resource officer, connected Daryl Baldwin, a tribal citizen, with a linguist, David Costa, who was doing his dissertation on the Miami language. And the two of them got together. And that's really where the language revitalization started. And from their efforts at the beginning of recreating the language as a the Miami language as a spoken language, because there were extensive Jesuit documents that documented the language, but it just has not been spoken in so long. So they brought that language, so to speak, back to life. And it's one of the terms we like to use in terms of cultural and language revitalization is picking up these threads of knowledge. And that is one of the threads that was picked up was the language. And their efforts have spurned what's now called the Miami Center at Miami University. And that's a joint relationship or a joint project between the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and Miami University, where the Miami Center is the research arm for the tribe, for our culture and our language. And that's really where language and cultural revitalization has kind of taken place. What I do is I create opportunities for tribal members in Indiana to learn their culture, learn their language, and learn their history as well. So that's my little piece of this greater effort here in Indiana.
Well, when it comes to the language and being able to sort of bring it back and discuss it and learn it, what were some things that you learned, Doug, with the language? And we'll actually come back right after the break to touch up on that question. We're speaking with Diane Hunter, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Pikongi, the Community Programming Manager, also for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne. Just ahead, we'll look back at a conversation we had this week with WFYI education reporters on why Indiana violated federal law by issuing emergency special education licenses. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today is the Friday recap, where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. Up next, we'll hear from WFYI education reporters on why Indiana violated federal law by issuing emergency special education licenses. With us now are two investigative reporters from WFYI's education desk, Lee Gaines and Dylan Pierce McCoy. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Lee, I'll start with you. The headline to your story last week is Indiana violated federal law by using emergency special education licenses. What is the federal law that we're talking about here?
So we're talking about the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It's also known as IDEA. And it's the federal law that governs special education services. So the primary function of this law is to ensure that students with disabilities receive a free, appropriate public education. So for years, IDEA has required that special ed teachers be fully licensed. That means that they shouldn't be on what's called an emergency permit or a temporary license. They should be fully licensed, fully qualified to do their job. The one caveat to this is that they can be on a provisional license so long as they're actively working toward full licensure and enrolled in a program and receiving mentorship and support. So this issue about emergency permits and special education got some renewed attention when the Every Student Succeeds Act was signed into law in 2015 because it included a reference to this requirement.
So what are these emergency special education licenses? Have they always been issued by the state, or is this just due to the pandemic?
No, this is something that's been going on for a long time, historically, like all the way back into the 20th century. And emergency permits aren't just for special ed. They're actually issued for other subjects, too. So for things like math and science, for example, basically what they do is they allow anyone with a bachelor's degree to teach a subject that they're not technically qualified to teach. And so schools turn to emergency permits when they can't find a fully qualified teacher for the job. And the use of emergency permits for special education has increased significantly in Indiana over the last several years. And we've been told by schools that that's because of a longstanding special ed teacher shortage.
Well, Dylan, how did you come across this story?
You know, I was reading a application from the state for federal funding where the Department of Education references, like, the special education teacher shortage we have and how we're relying on these emergency permits for special ed teachers. And I just sort of had a moment where I recognized, like, we are asking people who don't have full qualifications to teach some of the most vulnerable students in this state. And it's a lot. Like, we issued more than 1,200 emergency permits in the 2019-20 school year for special education. So this is a big part of our special education workforce, and these folks don't meet the licensure rules that we set. Like, we've said what it takes to be qualified. They don't meet those expectations. So after I sort of realized that, I was looking into that more, and I was just Googling, and I found a memo from the Department of Education this summer saying, this is actually a violation of federal law, and we're going to stop doing it next year. And that's what set Lee and I down this path of reporting on why they're making this policy change and eliminating emergency permits, and also what that's going to mean for students and schools. And it turns out it could have a really big impact.
And what kind of impact could it have, and what has it had so far on students in special education?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing you have to recognize is how students in special ed are being impacted by the fact that they're being taught by teachers on emergency permits. Like, these students really are the students that we want to have the most qualified and prepared teachers. And in fact, what's happening is that these vulnerable students are being taught by people who aren't fully qualified for the job. There's a big range of teachers who have emergency permits. Sometimes you'll have an emergency permit to teach special education, but you'll actually be a licensed teacher already. Maybe you're licensed in general ed, or you're a licensed gym teacher that's getting hired to teach special ed, and so you need an emergency permit. But we also talked to people who had no teaching experience at all, and they were getting these special ed emergency permits. So basically what's happening is the shortage of special ed teachers is leading us to bring in folks who really aren't prepared for the job to teach special ed. At the same time, when we end the use of emergency permits, the administrators and special ed teachers we talked to basically said this could cause another big problem, which is that they won't be able to fill these positions at all. So they're really worried that without teachers on emergency permits, they're going to have fewer special ed teachers overall, and the fully licensed teachers that are in those jobs will have higher caseloads, and that will make it harder for them to do their jobs well, which could be bad for the students that they do have. It could make their jobs more stressful and actually lead to higher turnover in the end. So this has a big impact on students now, but the policy change we're making will also, students could really suffer in the long term.
Lee, has the federal government done anything with regards to Indiana violating federal law?
No, we haven't seen any penalties. We haven't been told there's been any penalties at all. So a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Education did confirm to us that under federal law, special ed teachers should be fully licensed, or as I said a little while earlier, they should be enrolled in programs actively working towards their licenses. And so they shouldn't be on emergency permits. That is for sure. And we were also told by the federal government that when states submit their applications for federal funding, they're submitting assurances that they're following federal special ed law. So a spokesperson for the Indiana Department of Education told us that the federal government has provided guidance to help the state comply with the law rather than doling out any punishment. And, you know, honestly, that makes a lot of sense because one of the primary mechanisms for punishment in this situation would be to withhold federal funding. And I think everyone would agree that that would actually be more harmful to the students that Dylan was just talking about.
Well, Dylan, what is the state's response to all of this?
I mean, they're responding to the fact that we're currently in violation of federal law by ending the use of emergency permits. They also know that could be a challenge for schools. So they say they're going to try and smooth that transition. One thing that they're going to be doing is offering tuition assistance for folks who want to go into special ed teacher training programs. The idea being that they could get those temporary 3-year licenses if they're in a transition to teach program or another program that will lead to a special ed license at the end. So they're hoping that can plug some of this. But I think we're also just sort of waiting to see if there are other things we can do to address the special ed teacher shortage. I sat down with Rep. Bob Boehning, who's the chair of the House Education Committee, to discuss this issue the other day. And he said he was really concerned that schools won't be able to hire enough special ed teachers if they can't use emergency permits. And it's especially concerning because schools only have a year to make this change. And that's a pretty short runway. He said that the legislature might need to do more to address the special ed teacher shortage. And I'm going to share a little bit of what he said to me the other day.
We need to start looking more realistic in terms of the responsibility of a special ed teacher versus a traditional classroom teacher. And, it is much more, it's a situation that requires a lot more expertise, more training potentially. So perhaps we ought to be looking at salary structures a little bit too.
That's an interesting take on it. Do you think that those are things that need to be weighed on?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting issue to watch the legislature tackle. We know we have a special ed teacher shortage. We've had it for years, and we haven't really made progress on it. It actually seems to be getting worse. I talked to lawmakers, Republican and Democratic lawmakers, and they agree that this problem is really serious. They agree that the state needs to do something to incentivize people to become special ed teachers. But what the solution is, I think, could actually prove to be more controversial once we sort of dig down into it. What Rep. Boehning is suggesting is that maybe special ed teachers should be paid more than teachers in other areas. You know, he's saying their job is harder and we can't fill those positions, so we should potentially be paying special ed teachers more than we're paying a elementary school teacher. But that's not typical of the way that teacher contracts work. Normally, teacher contracts sort of stipulate that teachers are paid the same amount across fields. So you might be an elementary school teacher or you might be a math teacher, and you're going to be getting paid the same amount typically. And so changing that would actually be a pretty controversial move. So I'm going to be really interested to see if this gets the kind of attention we might expect in the legislature this session. And if so, whether it becomes a fight or whether there are areas of consensus that lawmakers and advocates believe will really move the needle on this.
Lee, you talked to Jenny Smithson, a member of the Indiana Council of Administrators for Special Education and the special ed director for Muncie Community Schools. What did you hear from her?
So to be clear, you know, Smithson agrees that all special ed teachers should be fully licensed, that the state of Indiana should be following federal law here. But the reality is that schools are struggling to hire those individuals. You know, she says they've become increasingly reliant on emergency permits to fill the gap and make sure students have at least, you know, some teacher in the classroom. You know, something that she is concerned about is that if you eliminate these emergency permits, then that means that there will be more students on the caseloads of fully licensed special ed teachers in districts. And, you know, I've heard anecdotally that those caseloads are already really high. And so we actually have a clip of Smithson talking about this.
And how do you help them keep from that burnout that happens when you have a caseload that's way higher than you should? I mean, we don't have caseload limits here in Indiana like some states do. So, I mean, we have the kids, we have to serve them. And if we only have so many licensed teachers, then we have to spread the love.
So there isn't a limit on how many caseloads teachers can take?
Yeah, there is no limit on the number of students and on a special ed teacher's caseload. You know, I've heard numbers ranging from like 20 to more than 30 for teachers. And then we also have this issue that Smithson talked to me about, which is the cost to get certified to teach special ed. So, you know, you're a new teacher, you realize that this is something you're passionate about and you want to do, and there's a huge shortage, so there's a lot of jobs in special ed, and you decide to go back to school and, you know, get that certification. And here's Smithson talking about the issue with that.
I mean, some school districts had a starting salary of like $34,000. How do you pay back your student loans and pay all your bills and work on your degree in special ed at the same time? It's been hard for them to try to do that.
And something I want to note here is that the state of Indiana is planning to roll out a tuition reimbursement program. That's something that they've told us. So if you are actively seeking your special ed credentials, you should be able to get some money back from the state. But they haven't released details on that program. And as Dylan mentioned, we only have a year runway, less than a year at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and just thinking of a salary of $34,000, that's, you know, you're getting a great deal to hire a teacher at that salary, but then not to give them the ability to pay back their loans and expect them to be taking special ed classes. That seems like a lot.
It is. It's a lot for anyone to do. And their work, you know, they're working full time. It's a time commitment as well as a money commitment.
Right, right. And Dylan, have any schools or school districts weighed in on this?
Yeah, absolutely. We reached out to some school districts to talk a little bit more about how they are preparing for this change. The school districts are under a lot of pressure right now, especially school districts that have relied on these emergency permits more than others. They're talking to local higher education institutions about what sort of transition to teacher programs exist and whether they're going to be able to get their teachers who are on emergency permits into those programs to make sure that they can get these temporary licenses that the state is going to be issuing. And they're working with teachers who are on emergency permits to make sure they, you know, finish up their schooling if they're in school right now so that they can get a regular permit. But they're still kind of scrambling. I spoke with an assistant superintendent in South Bend, and he told me that he's concerned that the district might not be able to hire enough special ed teachers next year. And that what that's going to mean is that the sort of students will suffer. The quality of their education will decline because caseloads will increase for the special ed teachers that the district does have.
Lee, are there any reasons that we didn't discuss that could be causing a shortage, a teacher shortage, particularly in special ed?
So we touched on this a little bit, but pay is one. You know, that's something that Representative Boehning mentioned. So, you know, Jenny Smithson said that is an issue for her. She really thinks that special ed teachers should be paid more. So as Dylan has mentioned, you know, you aren't guaranteed a higher salary than a general ed teacher if you become a special ed teacher. But at the same time, special ed teachers have extra paperwork responsibilities, and they also need to know and understand federal special ed law. You know, we've heard stories about special ed teachers becoming general ed teachers for that reason. You know, it's the same amount of pay for less paperwork. As I mentioned before, we've also heard about high caseloads contributing to burnout, and that can be an issue for retention, especially if maybe you're the only fully licensed special ed teacher in your district. That's a lot for an individual to take on. Another issue that we've heard about is special ed certification isn't a standard feature of a teacher prep program. So if you don't already know that you want to be a special ed teacher, you're not necessarily going to come out of school qualified to teach special ed. So you might be in the position of being that, you know, teacher making $34,000 to $40,000 a year. You realize that getting special ed certified is something you want to do, but then, oh, wait, you have to go back and do more coursework in order to do that. That could be, you know, that could deter you from wanting to get into special ed.
Well, we have about a minute and a half left. Dylan, can you tell us about Susan Harrison, a teacher you talked to for the story?
Yeah, Susan was a really interesting person to talk to. She was hired on an emergency permit a few years ago, and she had a lot of informal experience. She'd adopted young children with special needs, and she'd worked in a home-based daycare, but she had no formal teaching experience. She didn't have a license, and she really felt totally unqualified when she first got hired. I'm going to share a little bit of my interview with her.
I was scared to death just because it was something I'd never done before. And, you know, you have to write lesson plans. You have to, you know, monitor everybody's individual goals. There was no training and you were just put in a room and you were on your own. I had one of the administrators come out one day. She sat with me for an hour and that was my training.
And so it sounds like this is definitely an issue that has to be tackled.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, these are the most vulnerable students in the state that we're talking about. And as Dylan said before, they are the ones that honestly need the most qualified teachers.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon and shedding light on this very important topic. Lee Gaines and Dylan Piers McCoy are investigative reporters for WFYI's Education Desk. You can find their work at WFYI.org/news. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.